Today is lecture 5, and I have a lot of material prepared, thus I have to cut some presentation a little bit regarding these topics. So I will state the results of the topic, electrons moving in weak periodic potential. Then I will talk about tightly bound electrons and consider the Hamiltonian for non-interacting electrons on the lattice and its energy spectrum. But the last topic is very important because of its applicability to the study of strongly interacting systems, strongly correlated systems. So, but first of all, I will start by writing down the Schrödinger equation for the electrons moving in weak periodic potential. So, electrons moving in weak periodic potential. So the Schrödinger equation in momentum representation reads h bar squared q squared divided by 2m psi of q plus sum over all reciprocal lattice vectors u of k psi q minus k equal to 0. So, and we for simplicity assume that we have a one-dimensional system. We have the chain of atoms that create periodic potential, and the electrons move in this potential created by these atoms. So the period of the lattice is A.
Equals zero?
Hmm?
Equals zero? Where's the energy?
Yeah. E psi of q, absolutely, yeah. So, and the reciprocal lattice is also a one-dimensional chain with the period 2 pi over a. So this is our reciprocal lattice. So what happens if this potential is weak? When this potential is weak, we can use the perturbation series and try to seek the solution in the form. So for weak u of k, we imply that all components u of k for all reciprocal lattice vectors are small. We can seek the solution in the form. Psi of q equal to psi 0 of q plus psi 1 of q, then e equal to e 0 plus e 1 and so forth. So in the zeroth approximation, we will keep only psi 0 of q and e 0. And we have a very simple equation that h bar q squared divided by 2m minus e in the zero approximation times psi naught of q equal to 0. So this is the zeroth order approximation. It corresponds to neglecting the potential energy term created by periodic potential. So looking at this simple equation, we expect to recover the energy spectrum of the free particles. But we should keep in mind that all our states and energies are labeled by the band index and vector k belonging to the first brilliant zone. So if we look at this picture with received Purkle lattice, then we can draw the first brilliant zone. So let's assume that this is the origin, and this will be our first brilliant zone. So k varies between minus pi over a and pi over a. So k quasi-momentum belongs to the first brilliant zone, and we have another parameter called band index that basically translates this first brilliant zone by the corresponding reciprocal lattice vectors. So the solution of this simple equation can be written as follows. If kn is equal to 2 pi over a times n, and this is our reciprocal lattice vector, actually the set of reciprocal lattice vectors, we can write that En at the zero order is equal to h squared divided by 2m. And it's instead of q, we write small k belonging to the first brilliant zone minus kn. And this is squared. K varies between minus pi over a and pi over a. And if we subtract or add, it doesn't matter, various kn with various numbers n, we recover the whole spectrum of free electrons. Any questions at this point? We have absolutely no other choice. We must recover effectively the spectrum of free electrons, but write the solutions in such a way that they are labeled by a quasi-momentum k from the first brilliant zone and reciprocal lattice vectors kn. So the wave functions in the zero approximation have also a subscript k and band or zone index n, and it can be written in this form, E. Mm-hmm. I kx times E I kn x. So these solutions have the Bloch form. So this is the prefactor E in power I kx, and this plays the role of un k of x. That is periodic, with the period equal to r. So this is the zeroth order approximation. So it is instructive to draw the picture of this En0 as a function of its argument. So energy in the zeroth approximation that are functions of k minus kn. So we have the parabolic spectrum. parabolic spectrum, and small k varies between minus pi over a and pi over a, right? So this is our first brilliant zone. Yeah, if you have any questions, just ask. Our first brilliant zone. And this is the part of the spectrum corresponding to kn equal to 0. So k belongs to the first brilliant zone and lies in this segment. Now, if n is equal to minus 1, we have, let me just continue this, k minus kn large. Now, if n is equal to minus 1, then we have, another segment. It is actually called second brilliant zone. It corresponds to n equal to minus 1. And to the left, another segment stretches between minus pi over a and minus 3 pi over a. Better draw this way. I'm not very, very good at drawing. Okay. This segment corresponds to n equal to 1. So very good. Very, very good. We have just reproduced this expression, and we have the standard parabolic spectrum. But let's now ask ourselves a question. What if we have infinitesimally small periodic potential? Infinitesimally small, very, very, very weak, so in the limit tending to zero. What we must have the energy spectrum classified with two parameters, k and n. K is the quasi-momentum belonging to the first brilliant zone, and n is the band index. So this picture can be redrawn in the presence of infinitesimally small periodic potential as follows. We can take these two branches and fold them in such a way that they belong to the first brilliant zone. So this is equivalent to drawing the following picture. Energy.
Dennis?
Yep.
So I one thing, we are saying that the first two dot lines mark me the first brilliant zone, and the space between the other two is the second.
Yeah.
But brilliant zones shouldn't have the same volume. And the first one is like it has a 2 pi a width, and the second one, if I count, I have 2 pi a on both sides, so it's like 4 pi.
Oh, this is what I'm not sure about.
Okay.
Yeah, this one. This is the first brilliant zone that is only important. I don't remember exactly how second, third brilliant zone are constructed. So, but let's just assume that these segments simply correspond to reciprocal lattice vector kn with index n equal to minus 1. And this segment corresponds to kn with index n equal to 1. Let's just not then talk about terminology related to higher order brilliant zones. So they constructed. So, but what is important is that all other parts of the spectrum that stretch beyond the first brilliant zone must be shifted in such a way that their branches fit the first brilliant zone. So if we have the first Brillouin zones from minus pi over A to pi over A, then the, let me make it a little bit narrower, then the branch corresponding to n equal to 0 here remains at the same place. But this branch corresponding to n equal to minus 1 should be shifted, should be moved by adding k minus 1 in such a way that it begins from minus pi over a and ends at pi over a. Namely, we should, as a result of the shift, we have this branch. Similarly, we shift this branch to the right, and it starts from here. And ends at minus pi over n. So this is the part of the spectrum corresponding to n equal to 0. And these two parts correspond to the part of the spectrum that have here kn equal to minus 1 and kn equal to 1 respectively. So if you have infinitesimally small periodic potential, then your band structure or the zone structure looks like this. Yes?
Sorry, when you say infinitesimally small periodic potential, are you saying the period is infinitesimally small?
The strength. Yeah, the strength of the potential is infinitesimally small. Because once even infinitesimally small potential is added to the Schrodinger equation, we can no longer talk about ordinary momentum like for the free particles. We must talk about quasi-momentum k from the first Brillouin zone and band index. So this is the result of complete reclassification of the energy levels in the presence of periodic potential.
Thank you.
So in the presence of periodic potential, states are classified differently compared to the states when we have the motion over free particles. Then, finally, I am not, so this is essentially the result of solution of the Schrodinger equation in the zeroth order. Now we can go to higher orders. We can recall that we seek our solution in the form of the series and write down the equations for psi 1 and E 1, but I don't have time to do this. It's a quite long exercise. I will state the result. What happens if we include, say, the first and the second orders in perturbation? How this picture changes? We, of course, continue to assume that our potential is weak. And the picture changes as follows. We have our first Brillouin zone. So this is the picture for the case of weak but finite potential. We have our part of almost parabolic spectrum, almost parabolic spectrum. So of course there will be corrections to the spectrum, but the qualitative behavior won't change. And if you look at these points, you will see that these points are essentially the points of degeneracies, because two different bands meet here and here. And this is the point of degeneracy. So when you consider the perturbation theory that involves degenerate levels, you will see that instead of behaving this way, those branches, they approach minus pi over a in this way. And these branches start from some other higher values and behave like that. Taking into account the finite values of periodic potential leads to the gaps in the spectrum. So these are the gaps. And this is the gap. The energy levels that lie within these gaps are called prohibited energies. So when we have electrons in our system, they cannot have the energies corresponding to the intervals within the gaps. So we can write that gap corresponds to prohibited energies. These energies are allowed, these energies are prohibited. This is the result of calculations up to the second order in perturbation theory, up to the second order, because the first order is not enough here. Any questions about this picture? Yes.
Is this for specific potentials or for any sort?
This is a general result in one dimension, yeah. Yeah. So in fact, this gap is proportional to U of K1. If we know the expansion of the potential, then this is proportional to, yeah. Yeah, question.
You say that first order is not enough here. What do you mean by not enough?
Well, for first order, if you do the calculations, then you will see that first order in perturbation theory leads to a mere shift to the spectrum proportional to U of naught.
Lifts everything up.
Yeah, but typically we consider periodic potentials that, if averaged over the whole space, lead to zero, basically symmetric under inversion symmetry. In this case, U of naught is equal to zero identically. And otherwise, it shifts a little bit, either up or down. But typically, when we consider Hamiltonian, like in condensed matter with chemical potential, people say that those simple shifts simply renormalize chemical potential and don't lead to any new physics. Okay, this is the result. So if we start filling these energy levels, we have the classification of energy levels here, and here. If we start filling them, we'll start from the lowest energy, then go up. And when reaching the energy where the gap starts, and if we have more electrons, then the other electrons start filling the higher band. So we cannot have any electrons corresponding to those prohibited intervals of energies.
Okay.
So this is how the difference between metals and insulators is explained in solid-state physics and in condensed matter. When we talk about insulators, then we say that all bands are filled until the level corresponding to the large gap. So the cost for the electron to be excited to the next state is high. This means that this solid-state system behaves as an insulator because it costs a lot of energy to excite electron occupying the top of the allowed band. So in a three dimensions, the picture is similar. Okay, very good. And I will move to the next topic that is also very, very interesting. This topic called tightly bound electrons. So here, when the potential is weak, we always have that the gaps are quite small. So the distance in energies between the bands is small, while the distance of the bands itself is large. Now we consider the opposite case, the so-called case of tightly bound electrons. Tightly bound electrons. So I will start from the following. Let's consider just a single atom. Just a single atom. So we have the nucleus, and we have electrons that move around various orbitals. So for example, the outmost orbital is here. So there will be electrons that whose wave functions, let's call it this way in the quantum mechanical sense, is localized very close to the nucleus, but there will be electrons whose wave functions are peaked quite far. And we ask a question, if we have many such atoms, can we bring them together in such a way that they form a crystal? For this system, let's consider, for example, the electron occupying or moving around the outmost orbital. Then we have just a simple Schrödinger equation for this. So psi, I schematically, for simplicity, consider just the three-dimensional case, although of course it is three-dimensional, and the classification of energy levels will involve the momentum variables, and we also must take into account spins. But let's consider for simplicity the one-dimensional atom. What? This is just an idealization, but it allows us to understand what's happening. And the Schrödinger equation, say, for the electron moving in effective potential created by nucleus and by other electrons that are located close to the nucleus, can be written like this, plus some potential, I would call it V of x, psi, and equal to E of psi. And suppose that there is a bunch of bound states, and the ground state corresponding to one of the bound states is E0 smaller than zero. So energy of the lowest bound state. Of the lowest bound state. Right? We have some potential, and as a result of solution, we found some negative energy that appears to be the lowest. Very, very good. So this is a knot. Then there may be some other energies of the bound state, E1 smaller than zero. Then E2 smaller than zero. We have the discrete spectrum. So there are some gaps between these energies. But we have the specific energy of the lowest bound state, not smaller than zero. And let's assume that this electron in this state. Now we can ask the question, what happens if we bring many atoms together? Many atoms. Electron here, then nucleus here, then an electron here, and so forth. And I can continue. Then the electron of the outmost shell has the probability to tunnel or to hop between the sites or between the atoms that are located next to each other. Basically, those electrons become the collective property of the crystal. Namely, their wave functions are picked closer to this or that atom. And this is how the crystal is formed when we talk about the tight binding. The wave function of each electron is picked very close to the nucleus. But with equal probability, it can be picked around the nucleus of any atom in the crystal. So the question is, what happens to the energy spectrum in this case? For the case of a single atom, so suppose we have solved the Schrödinger equation, and we could find the energy spectrum. But what happens if we have many atoms brought together? What happens to this energy? And this is essentially the topic of this discussion for the remaining of this lecture. But first of all, rather than doing math starting from the Schrödinger equation rewritten above, like I did when I taught this course before, I will start from a more physical picture. And consider an auxiliary problem. Yeah, so if you have any questions, just interrupt. An auxiliary problem of the Schrödinger equation of the particle that moves in the delta functional potential. So, auxiliary problem. Auxiliary problem. Let's consider the Schrödinger equation. Minus h bar squared divided by 2m, of course, in one dimension. The second derivative of psi minus alpha delta of x psi equal to E psi. This just means that the potential energy has the form of delta functional potential well. So I will schematically write it like this. So how many of you saw the solution to this problem? Just raise your hand. I see that not all of you. So I will state briefly the solution. The importance of this problem and this Schrödinger equation, that it allows for only one bound state with negative energy, only one. It will have, of course, the continuous spectrum of positive energies, but the bound state is only one. So to solve, and I will briefly delineate the solution to this equation, because there will be, so it's an important and very illustrative example. So let's solve. Solve, introduce the parameter kappa equal to 2m absolute value of E divided by h bar and the square root of this. We are interested in negative energies because the energies of the bound states are always negative. So if we introduce this parameter, we seek the solution in the form. and seek psi of x in the following form. So it is equal to a e in power kappa x when x is greater is smaller than zero, right? Because the wave function of the bound state should be peaked around zero, but decay swiftly when we move away from the potential well. X smaller than zero and b in power minus kappa x when x is greater than zero. So then we must have that the wave function is itself continuous at zero. So psi of zero plus equal to psi of zero minus gives a equal to b. So the other equation that connects a and b is obtained when we integrate over the infinitesimal interval around x equal to zero. This will eat away the delta function. So we integrate the whole Schrodinger equation, and keeping in mind that psi is itself continuous, we have minus h squared divided by 2m psi of zero plus minus psi, psi, the derivative, the first derivative of psi taken at this very close to zero point at the positive psi, minus psi prime zero minus, okay, equal to alpha psi at zero itself. So if you just take into account that a is equal to b and substitute these forms, you will get that this will give the following: h bar squared divided by 2m kappa times 2, this comes from this, minus alpha equal to 0. So as a result, you have that 2 times E is equal to m alpha squared divided by h bar squared. And E itself, actually, let's call it E naught. E naught, it is negative, equal to minus m alpha squared divided by 2 h bar squared smaller than zero. So this is the energy of the only bound state. Okay, any questions with this? The energy of the only bound state. So the normalized wave function is psi naught of x is equal to the square root of kappa 0 e in power minus kappa 0 absolute value of x. And it decays when x goes to plus and minus infinity, but is peaked around x equal to 0. It depends on x in a non-analytic way, because the absolute value of x means non-analyticity. You can ask a question, and why is this problem so important? Well, first of all, it is very simple because it leads to only one bound state and one level with negative energy. But it also allows us to address the more complicated question. What happens if we have not one delta functional potential well, but two of them, or three, or four, or many of them? In fact, it is possible to solve the Schrodinger equation if we have many potential wells separated by the same distance. So I don't remember how this potential is called. It's probably called the Comb potential somewhere. But
it's a Dirac Comb.
Yeah, it's a Dirac Comb. Yeah, it's a Dirac Comb. So, but let's consider the more complicated problem when we have two delta functional wells located at points minus A and A. And assume that they are separated rather far from each other. We assume that kappa naught A is much greater than 1. So kappa naught, as follows from this line of considerations, is equal to m alpha divided by h bar squared. So the question is, can we solve the Schrodinger equation in this case? Yeah, yes we can. And so I put on the wiki the appendix to lecture 5 that solves exactly the Schrodinger equation in this case. But we will obtain the approximate values of energy under this condition from the variational principle and try to guess the approximate form of the wave functions we will be using to obtain the energies. I can tell you that the result is that this single energy level splits into two closely separated levels when we have this condition. So let's use as trial wave functions the following functions: psi large, I will write the large psi, plus minus of x equal to 1 over the square root of 2, psi naught x minus a plus minus psi naught x plus a. What I did, I just constructed two linear combinations that are independent from each other, that involve functions psi naught that are written there. This function, psi naught of x minus a, is peaked around x equal to a, while the other wave function is peaked around x minus a. So this just means that we are seeking the solution to the Schrodinger equation in the form of superposition of two wave functions, one describing the electrons that is located near, close to this well, the other describing the electron located near this well. This is, of course, an approximation, because in reality, of course, the electron can be found anywhere, right? Anywhere, so with big or small probability. But this choice reflects the situation when the probability to be found for the probability for the electron to be found somewhere between the well is small, and it can be found either near one well or near the other well. So let's obtain the energy levels based on these two trial wave functions. So we have E plus minus equal to 1 over the integral from minus infinity to infinity of psi plus minus square x dx times, write this one, the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity dx psi plus minus x h plus minus x. Let's find E plus minus assuming the validity of this condition. So I won't, of course, write all the intermediate steps, but I will write that using the fact that minus H bar squared divided by 2m psi 0 double prime x plus minus A is equal to a naught psi 0 x plus minus a plus alpha delta function of x plus minus a psi naught x plus minus a, we can show that when h acts on psi plus minus, we have just h acting on psi plus minus of x equal to E naught psi plus minus of x minus alpha divided by square root of 2 delta x plus a psi naught x minus a minus plus alpha divided by square root of 2 delta x minus a psi naught x plus a. It's just a simple algebra. You make this substitution that follows from this Schrodinger equation, and carefully look at the signs, the sum term will cancel, and you will arrive at this result. So this result is very important, very, very nice, because when we multiply the whole this equation by psi plus minus x and integrate, we will very nicely eliminate these delta functions. So we have that integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, psi plus minus x, h psi plus minus x is equal to E naught psi plus minus x squared dx minus alpha divided by square root of 2, and here we have psi plus minus minus a times psi naught minus 2a minus plus alpha divided by square root of 2 psi plus minus of a equal to psi naught divided by 2a. And if we divide by this integral, we just recover our energy level. So let's do it here. So integral minus plus psi plus minus squared x divided by this, we eliminate this. So and write this bracket divided by this integral from minus infinity plus infinity psi plus minus square root of x dx. This will be our energy levels, 2 plus minus. So this is just the algebra. I went very, very quickly on it. So what do we observe? We observe that those psi naught taken at 2 alpha and minus 2 alpha are exponentially small. They are exponentially small given this condition, kappa naught a much greater than 1. This follows from this formula. So when we substitute x equal to plus minus 2 alpha, then we will receive exponentially small contribution. So looking at this expression and taking into account the exponential smallness of these terms, we can also take the approximate solutions to psi plus minus taken at a and minus a. So we write that since psi naught of plus minus 2a equal to square root of kappa e in power minus 2 kappa naught a, they are much smaller than 1, we can set psi plus minus of a equal to square root of kappa naught divided by 2, and psi plus minus taken at a equal to plus minus square root of kappa naught divided by 2. And moreover, this integral can be also set equal to 1. And we can set integral from minus infinity to infinity of psi plus minus squared x equal 2. So let me write it down in more detail. So 1 over 2 psi naught x minus a plus minus psi naught x plus plus a squared dx equal to 1, because these functions are normalized. When we take square of this term and this square of this term, we get 1. This will cancel the prefactor of 2. So, and 1 plus minus infinity to infinity psi naught x minus a psi naught x plus a dx. And this is approximately equal to 1, because this integral is exponentially small given this condition. Why is this? Because this is nothing else than the overlap of two wave functions that are picked very far apart. So this is exponentially small. And we can set it equal to 1. So any questions here?
Yeah. We have just briefly like 2 times the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like plus
where?
Plus minus in the second line, just before and we can set.
Yeah.
No. On the top.
On the top.
Yeah, it's like.
But it is plus minus a kappa naught, square root of kappa naught divided by 2, right?
Sorry?
So you're asking about this expression, psi plus minus taken at plus a and minus a, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if we look at the our expression, so plus minus x equal to this psi naught of x. So first comes minus a plus minus psi naught x plus a and look at this expression and substitute. I would say let's take psi minus at a, right? So it is equal to 1 of the square root. If we put a here, then we get square root of kappa naught. Ax is equal to a, and we get so plus minus square root of kappa naught e in power minus 2 kappa naught a, right?
Yeah.
Right? So this term is exponentially small. It's exponentially small, so we're just keeping this term only. And a similar thing for other parameters. I decided simply to skip the intermediate steps.
No, but I'm saying that in the second one, there should be a minus a inside the parentheses.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sorry, thank you. I simply misunderstood
your
questions. Question trying to save time. Oh, sorry. So, okay, then we can write that as a result of all this algebra we have. As a result, e plus minus equal to e naught minus plus alpha kappa naught e in power minus 2 kappa naught a. Or we can label this term as simply t and write that it is equal to e naught minus plus t. T is a small correction to the energy level E naught. So what do we see? We see that our initial energy level E naught that is smaller than zero has split into two closely spaced levels that are different one from each other by the value equal to 2t. So we had this for one well. And as a result of adding the second well, we have now two energy levels. And the distance between them is equal to 2t. It is essential that we have here e plus minus and have here minus plus. Isn't it surprising? It's not. Why? Can you say why? It's not surprising because the symmetric wave function with plus must necessarily have lower energy. It becomes a ground state energy in the system of two wells. While anti-symmetric is the first excited state. Fully in agreement with the laws of quantum mechanics. why did I spend so much time considering this simple case? The reason is because we can consider a formal Hamiltonian. Formal Hamiltonian that is the second quantized Hamiltonian, and it involves two sides, side one and side two. Side one and side two. And let's consider our Hamiltonian in the following way. H equal to E naught C1 dagger C1 plus C2 dagger C2 minus T C1 dagger C2 plus C2 dagger C1. The Hilbert space of this Hamiltonian involves just two states. Just two states if we have just one particle. Suppose that we have just one particle, don't worry about spin, just one electron that can be occupy either site one or site two. So we have two states. State one in which site one is occupied and the second site is empty, and site two in which the first site is empty and the second site is occupied. Just two states. So, just any questions about this? Any questions? So, the operator C1 dagger creates the particle at state one. Operator C2 dagger creates a particle and state two, so no, nothing else. Then, it is just a very simple exercise to check that, easy to check, that the linear combinations plus minus equal to 1 over square root of 2, 1 plus minus 2, are the eigenstates of H corresponding to the energies E plus minus. That's all. This is the simplest tight binding Hamiltonian in the second quantized notation that involves just two sides. Just two sides. This part is called the hopping part. Hopping part. Well, why is it called hopping part? Because it eliminates particle, electron, at one side and moves and creates it in the neighboring side. So it hops. Basically, due to the presence of this part, our particle hops from site one to site two and vice versa, from site two to site one. So in our problem, the hopping part involving the energy scale T is much smaller than energy scale E naught. So any questions?
The C dagger squared.
C dagger?
I know, but are those fermionic creations of annihilations or bosonic? Or
well, in this case, they can be both.
Yeah.
In this case, they can be both. Yeah, because we just consider a particle. It can be either fermion, it's just one particle. As I said, one particle that can hop between the sides. So, yeah. They are just creation and annihilation operators. So, So what we do next, we, based on this simple example, generalize this Hamiltonian for the case when we have many, many sets. And this time, consider fermionic operator and fermions with spins. So, and during next several minutes remaining, I will do exactly that. And simply obtain the energy spectrum of the tight binding Hamiltonian on a lattice. Binding Hamiltonian on the lattice. So we had just two sets, and why not to generalize this to the case when we have many sets? And let's for simplicity consider once again the one-dimensional chain of sets and write down the Hamiltonian. H equal to sum over n sigma a naught Cn sigma dagger Cn sigma minus T N sigma C N sigma C N plus 1 comma sigma dagger plus the Hermitian conjugate C N plus 1 comma dagger. The annihilation operator C N sigma dagger, the creation operator. So this is the local part. And this is the hopping part. It creates, sorry, it eliminates electron, say, on one particular side, and creates on the neighboring side. So it allows, it leads to the hopping of electrons from side to side. And this is how the motion of an electron along the chain takes place. I have a question that is very simple, how to obtain the energy spectrum of this Hamiltonian. So to obtain the energy spectrum, we introduce the Fourier transformed operators based on already existing creation and annihilation operators we have just in real space. Fourier transform. Operators. So our operators are fermionic. They create and annihilate particles with spin at various sites. And we have Cn sigma dagger equal to 1 over square root of n. N is the number of sites. Sum over k, Ck sigma dagger e in power I k n a. And Cn sigma equal to 1 over square root of n, sum over k, Ck sigma, e in power minus I, kna. So it is easy to write down the inverse Fourier transforms, but just I will skip this step. And substitute this expression into our Hamiltonian. So Ck, sigma dagger are fermionic annihilation creation operators. So it is also an interesting exercise to check that if C CK sigma and CK sigma dagger obey anti-commutation rules, then the original operators obey anti-commutation rules as well. Or you can vice versa write down the inverse Fourier transformations and based on anti-commutativity check that everything is in order. So Fourier transformed operators are also fermionic. The operator CK sigma, it creates a particle in the state with quasi-momentum K that has spin sigma. And CK sigma dagger, and CK sigma just eliminate the particle with quasi-momentum K having spin sigma. Substitution of these Fourier transforms into this Hamiltonian is called diagonalizing Hamiltonian H. So when we substitute and do all the algebra, we will see that our Hamiltonian becomes diagonal. So I will leave, yes, question.
Why are they specifically fermionic?
I decided to consider just fermionic Hamiltonian. You can, of course, consider bosons hopping between the sides on the lattice. In this case, you have to introduce the Fourier transforms for bosonic creation and annihilation operator that will obey commutation statistics rather than anti-commutation. So when we substitute this, so I will leave it as an exercise. When we substitute this, we have H equal to sum over K, comma sigma, epsilon K sigma, C K sigma, C K sigma, where epsilon K sigma is equal to E naught minus 2T cosine K A. So where A is the period of our lattice. So, and N is the number of sites. Okay, so this is the spectrum. So if we have N sites, then because, and we assume the periodic boundary conditions, then we have n discrete values of k. For n sites, k's assume the values equal to 2 pi over n a, so can be 0, 1, and up to n minus 1. So our original energy level E naught splits on n very closely spaced levels because now we have the crystal of n atoms. So any questions?
And what happens to the state with the normalization? That 1 over square root of n when we have a very big lattice?
We
can consider an infinite lattice or not.
So in this case, we first consider the finite lattice, for a finite lattice of n atoms, but imply taking the thermodynamic limit afterwards and going to infinity. In this case, this discrete set of k's becomes continuous. And when we calculate the physical quantities on the lattice, we substitute sum over k by an integral over k, but from the first Brillouin zone.
Okay. And the Fourier transform, we perform it on the whole k space.
No, not on the whole k space, for k's belonging to the first Brillouin zone. only. So everything here, if you could look at our expression, I could also write, say, from the integral from n minus 1 over 2 up to n minus 1 over 2. So k belongs to the first Brillouin zone. In this case, the first Brillouin zone stretches from 0 to 2 pi over a, that is actually it is possible to shift it. So any other questions? Because this is probably time for us to finish our course.
Why does k take those values?
Because we assume periodic boundary conditions. Basically, the first side.
But k is a quasi-momentum, right?
Yes, k is a quasi-momentum, right?
Boundary conditions inside the cell, not inside the whole thing, right?
K is a quasi-momentum, right? Yes, yes. So if you have any further questions, you can just ask me shortly after the lecture. So, otherwise, I skipped quite many intermediate steps. So the intermediate steps are in my notes, in my notes. So, but I am very happy to answer questions. So we don't have simply much time because it's time for us to go for lunch. Then, if there are no questions, thank you for your attention.